This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've been talking about the current wave of bills attacking the rights of transgender adults and children in states like Arkansas, Alabama, and more than 30 other states this year. Many of those bills address medical care and would restrict access to medical care for kids under 18 and even those under 21 in the case of North Carolina. And that's what we want to talk about next, that medical care and what gender-affirming care means to the people who receive it. Here's just a short sample of what trans listeners have told us this week about their experiences.
About a year and a half ago, I finally came out as non-binary. 3 weeks ago, I had top surgery. And immediately after having the surgery, I felt totally better. My body matched my understanding of my body and my feelings about who I was and how I presented myself.
Being on the right hormones, getting the surgery I needed, it's allowed me to feel so much more comfortable in my skin and confident and less anxious in my day-to-day. I really feel like it's given me my life, like that my life has now started.
Gender-affirming care isn't simply hormones and surgery and trans-specific healthcare. Gender-affirming healthcare is being treated with respect and having the reality of my existence respected by a doctor regardless of their specialty. I've received that, but I've also definitely not.
All the research essentially boils down to this. Provide a supportive, caring environment for trans kids, and they do fine. The research shows that it's not anything inherent in being trans that causes depression, anxiety, and suicide. It's the lack of acceptance.
You know, the only really regret I have is that I couldn't have accessed gender-affirming care earlier as a teenager. Because to me, it's like looking back on those years that I could have started living my life earlier.
Thank you, listeners, DB, Alex, and Sammy, and therapist Laura Jacobs for your contributions. And here to talk with us about gender-affirming healthcare are my guests, Dr. Alex Yontefi, PhD, a family therapist who works with trans and gender nonconforming adults and children, as well as their families. Dr. Yontefi is also host of the Gender Stories podcast. Dr. Yontefi joins us from Minneapolis. And Dr. Kara Connolly, MD, a pediatric endocrinologist and medical director for the Gender Clinic at Oregon Health and Science University's Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Portland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's get right into that. What is gender-affirming health care for children, Kara?
So gender-affirming health care is actually a little bit hard to define in just one or two sentences. It is all-encompassing. It is providing basic health care, primary care for children and adolescents. It can mean just being affirmed and supported in their gender. It doesn't necessarily mean medications that are changing the hormones in their bodies, but it can. So for some children who are starting a puberty that they were born with, if it's not in alignment with their gender identity, and if their body is starting to change in ways that are not in alignment with their gender identity, we have medicines that can prevent those changes from happening. It's a category of medicines that we often refer to as pubertal suppression or puberty blockers or hormone blockers. And they're very effective at stopping puberty or pausing puberty. We often say it's like pushing the pause button on puberty so that their bodies don't continue to change in those ways.
Can you be specific about that? Is it for hormonal therapy? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so basically what these medicines do is they suppress the puberty hormones that are produced by the pituitary gland in the brain, so that there's no message being sent down to the testicles or the ovaries telling them to make testosterone or estrogen. Those hormones, those puberty hormones, cause changes to the body, like chest or breast development for somebody who has ovaries and makes estrogen, and eventually menstrual cycles. And then for kids who have testicles and make testosterone, those changes that come along with puberty are voice deepening and changing of the bone structure, facial and body hair. So these medicines will suppress those hormones so they're not causing those changes to the body that are permanent. and may be really distressing to kids.
Is there anything else that you need to factor into a young person's care when they're on puberty blockers?
When kids are on puberty blockers, the main thing that we think about is just the fact that we are pausing puberty hormones in the body. The main thing effect that puberty hormones can also have on is on the bones. So we take great care in thinking about bone health. We recognize that bones eventually do need hormones. So we support young people in making decisions about when and whether to start cross hormone therapy. And we want to make sure that we keep bones healthy in all other ways. So making sure that they get enough calcium and vitamin D, regular weight-bearing exercise, and then we can monitor bone density using bone density scans.
Mm-hmm. And Alex, let's talk about your line of work, about when it comes to therapy and counseling. What does gender affirmation look like in your work?
The first and most basic rule of gender affirming care, I would say, is to be able to see and recognize the person for who they are. So affirming their name, affirming their pronouns, that's the kind of the most basic level of which we can meet somebody. And then also it's about making sure that if there is a desire to transition, whether that transition is social, so for example, changing name and pronouns, legal, changing name and gender marker legally, or medical, such as accessing puberty blocker or cross hormones, that there is support for that young person and their families to fully understand the process and fully understand the options that they have. Often one thing that I say to my clients is that I want this transition in their lives to kind of bring them closer as a family rather than drive a wedge between them. And that's very much my job as a family therapist. And as Kara said, kind of hitting the pause on that puberty button can be so fruitful for therapeutic work, because then it gives young people the chance to really explore their feelings if they're experiencing any dysphoria. So a sense of disease, lack of ease in their body because of the pubertal changes, they can have all the space they need to decide for themselves what they want their lives to look like. Because often we think that transitioning looks one way, but there are many different options when we look at gender affirming care. Some people might want to change their name and pronouns, some people don't. Some people might want to access hormone therapy and maybe later in life, even kind of body modification, such as gender affirming surgeries, and some people don't. And giving young people and their families the space to explore, the space to have challenging conversations around what do they want to do around their reproductive capacity, for example, as they get older and they're contemplating cross hormones, can be really helpful. Nothing happens quickly. I also want to make it clear that nobody is giving like hormones or puberty blockers to children as young as like 4 or 5. What is happening in terms of gender affirming care with those younger children is that they are telling us, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, I'm a boy and a girl, and they might want to play with what clothes they're wearing, how they do their hair, what name they're using, and what pronouns people are using for them. But usually medical care doesn't come in until much later when those pubertal changes start to come into the picture.
That's very interesting. Care, all these kinds of treatments, mental health, medical, there is real science behind this, is there not?
Absolutely. I think one of the misconceptions is that that the care is not well researched, and in reality it is. First of all, our treatments we've been using for over 50 years. These are not new medicines. Many of the puberty blocking medicines were developed for a medical condition called central precocious puberty for children who go into puberty at too young of an age, so like 5 or 6 years old. We can use those medicines to pause puberties for those kids. And so we have many, many years of experience and understanding how these medicines work and what their safety and efficacy are. And we've been using these medications for kids who identify as gender diverse or transgender for over 2 decades. And again, have a lot of evidence that they are safe, they are effective, and they provide long-term benefits, both emotionally, physically, psychosocially, and result in kids who are healthier, with lower risks of depression, anxiety, lower risk of suicidal ideation or suicidality. And they're able to be who they are authentically and thrive in their lives and their relationships. In terms of hormones, hormone replacement therapy or cross-hormone therapy, again, we've been using the exact same hormones for many, many decades, over 50 years, for people who don't make enough hormones on their own. And when we prescribe hormones, we're prescribing them in replacement doses. So we prescribe hormones that would achieve hormone levels in the blood that would mimic what a person that age would naturally be producing, and we don't exceed that. So for those reasons, we don't see negative health consequences because we are simply replacing what the young person is not making enough of.
One thing that people arguing for those bills keep saying, this idea that trans kids aren't ready to make decisions and they might regret the decision they do make. Kara, Alex, let me begin with you. Kara, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I can appreciate that question. And I think one of the things that's important to recognize and remember is that, just like Alex said, these decisions are not taken lightly. We work with the whole family unit to help them make decisions and help the young person make the decision about whether this is the right thing for them and whether this is the right time for them. The care that we provide is interdisciplinary with integrated social work, behavioral health, medical, and in helping the young person make these decisions. But in reality, these young people know who they are, and they are looking to us to help them to achieve those long-term goals so that they are able to express who they are to the rest of the world. But they know their gender identity. It's deeply rooted internally as who they are. And when, you know, even so, when we meet with young people, we always discuss the possibility that they may decide to change direction. So as Alex was talking about the train, we often refer to somebody who's pursuing medical interventions as being on a journey with many different paths that they can choose to take, just like Alex was saying with the different interventions that they may or may not, that may or may not be part of their journey. And if somebody is going down one path, they may decide to change course, and we support them in those decisions. We always bring up the possibility of them deciding that if they start a medicine, that they don't want to be on the medicine anymore. And anytime we start a medication, we follow up with our patients very closely with return visits every 3 to 4 months. At those visits, we talk about how they're feeling on those medications, how they're feeling with the changes that they're noticing to their body. And if the changes aren't feeling affirming to them at any point in time, then we can decide to stop it or change directions.
I don't think that's something that people understand, Alex, very much.
I agree. Sometimes there are so many misconceptions out there about what gender-affirming care looks like at this point. And I think that one of the things that's important to remember is that young people make decisions about their life all the time, and they do make decisions about their medical care with their parents all the time. But somehow when it comes to transgender and or non-binary children, we think that they're somehow set apart from their cisgender peers. And one of the studies that I think was published in 2019 clearly identified that the gender identity development trajectory for transgender and non-binary children is very similar to that for cisgender children. That means that most children know who they are in terms of their gender identity between the ages of 3 to 5 years old. And so if they are in an environment that's affirming enough and safe enough for them to say to the world and announce who they are, that's usually when a child says, I'm a girl, I'm a boy, I'm a girl and a boy, or I'm not a girl and I'm not a boy. And of course, they're expressing their identity in a way that is age appropriate to them. And like I said, there is no medical intervention beside kind of behavioral health support, such as family therapy, that happens at that stage. As they get older, they develop an understanding of their gender identity and expression that kind of grows with them, just like all of us do. Probably most of us have a memory of being 4 or 5 or 6 years old and knowing what we wear, knowing what kind of toys we like to play with, what kind of clothes we like to wear. And it's really no different for transgender children. I think people often seems to think that maybe there's been undue influence on those children. And the reality is that even though now we do have the internet and children can access language to describe themselves at a much younger age, the reality is that children have always developed a strong sense of identity without those influences. For example, I was born and brought up in Italy in the early 70s. There were no transgender people around me, but I knew as a young child that when people thought I was a boy, that made me happy. I didn't know the terms gender euphoria, which I know now, but I realized that I was feeling seen and affirmed by my peers or by strangers at the park because I had a short haircut and some sweatpants on, right? I didn't know that I hadn't read kind of gender theory, and I didn't know that transgender people existed, but I knew who I was. And that's true for many children. They know who they are. And then when it comes to medical treatment, if they're minors, the medical treatment is usually negotiated with the parents, which is why people like family therapists are so important during that negotiation. And the reality is that parents often don't have any problem giving hormonal care to their children if they're not trans. For example, if the child has acne, there might be hormonal treatment that's recommended and that is not seen as problematic. Or if the child is starting to hit puberty at 8 years old or 9 years old, again, there is no problem for them accessing puberty blockers. But somehow when it comes to transgender children, it's almost as if people put them on a different category than the rest of humanity. And I think that's one of the main things to remember is that trans children are children first. And so as children, they know who they are. They need to be respected. They need to be listened to and heard. And they have the right to access the medical care that can be so helpful and that is kind of evidence-based and that is recommended by most professional associations on an interdisciplinary level.
If I'm a parent, what's the best practice for responding to my child who is questioning their gender or realizing they are trans? Let me begin with you, Alex.
Absolutely. What a great question. Well, as a parent and a family therapist, I think when a child discloses something like that, the first answer needs to be, thank you so much for trusting me with that information. I'm so glad that you felt you could come to me and share that with me. And then the next question needs to be, what does that mean to you? What would you like me to do differently? And I think that's a really important question that parents need to ask is, how can I support you? What would you like me to do differently? And let their children know that there is space here for them to explore, because gender is a journey. And also we can change our mind throughout our life. The way we express our gender as 5 or 7 years old is not the same way we express it when we're 40 or 50 or 70. And that's true for all of us, trans folks or not. And so for a parent to just meet their child and know that they're listened to, that they're loved. Also, of course, I love you no matter what, and I'm with you. You're not alone, right? Because children can feel so alone. And children are aware that all this anti-trans sentiments are going on because they access social media, and they need to know that their families are on their side, because research tells us that family support is the biggest factor for resilience. Family support lowers suicidality, lowers symptoms of depression, anxiety. It's the thing that is most needed by trans youth.
So both of you, how have you seen kids respond to receiving gender-affirming care?
It's just an absolutely incredible experience to be able to work with these young people and their families and to be able to witness with our own eyes how they our treatments help them to blossom and thrive and be successful in their relationships and do well in school and graduate and go on to pursue higher education and really wonderful jobs. And I think one of the most unique and special thing is just watching how this care strengthens their relationship with their family. Almost every single young person that we see in our clinic after they receive our care come back to clinic with their parents telling us, this is the first time that I've seen them come out of their room and interact with the family in years. They're now developing new relationships. They're going to school. They're smiling for the first time. And that is just, it's just incredible to witness. And that cannot be minimized when we're thinking about these bills that are going to strip this away from them. This care is just, as Alex said, it's life-saving.
Likewise, I feel, you know, as Kara, I feel like I could have this conversation for hours, as Christy knows, because the other night I did keep it for a really long time. But I too am sad that with my brain fog today, I was like, oh, I didn't talk about how gender affirming care is actually life-saving because of the high rates of suicidality in trans population. You know, our population has 10 times the rate of suicidality of compared to the general population. So gender affirming care is literally life-saving for many trans people, whether they're children, youth, or adults. And also that when people receive gender affirming care, not only can they survive, but they can thrive. You know, we see them connect with their parents better, connect with their peers better, participate in kind of everyday experience that a lot of cisgender children and youth take for granted, whether it's playing sports or going to prom or just hanging out with their friends, of course, when it's not a pandemic, maybe. But the really gender-affirming care allows children to be children and to blossom rather than being weighed down with dysphoria and depression and anxiety. It's really liberating for many young people.
And that's before any medical treatments even. It's just simply using the child's affirmed name and pronouns.
Absolutely. And I just want to add that sometimes when I work with families, if parents are not sure what does it look like to be gender affirming, I say, hey, let's do a little science experiment. Why don't you use your child's names and pronouns that they're asking you to use for a month? And see if you notice any differences. And often parents come back and say, it's like having my child back. Exactly what Kara was saying. They're coming out of their room, they're engaging with the family, they're feeling seen and affirmed and listened to, and therefore can relate to us in a completely different way.
And that really shows a difference immediately.
Yes, it can be that immediate. And I really want to stress, because sometimes people who are proposing those bills say, well, if that's enough, then why do we need additional medical care? And what I would say is that that is the beginning, right? To have that basic engagement. But then sometimes the onset of puberty can plunge children and young people back into depression and anxiety. And so being able to access medical care as well as kind of this sort of affirming care in therapy is really essential as well. It's not an either or, it's very much a both end. There needs to be an interdisciplinary team that works with the family.
Are there cases where the parents who hear their children talking about this go to a psychiatrist who might say, oh, I'm just going to throw some medication at your kid. Your kid will be better, you know, in a few months.
Yes, that happens. And hopefully psychiatrists are competent and know that one of the areas they need to explore is how people and young people especially might feel about their gender, because that's often when pubertal changes hit and there is a big change. I think that most providers would know that one of the things to explore is maybe gender identity. Sometimes this can be missed, and it goes back to what one of the listeners was saying about the difficulties of accessing gender specialists and gender affirming care. One of the things that we need to do, and it is increasingly happening, is to better educate our providers, whether they're medical providers or therapy providers, because one of the things that can happen is that people don't feel equipped to deal with gender. And so maybe a child is seeing a therapist and then, or a psychiatrist, and they come out as trans, and the therapist or psychiatrist says, oh, you need to go to see a gender specialist. And then that can be really harmful, because then the child feels, oh, I'm not like other children. I need to see a specialist. There's something so wrong and weird about me that now an average psychiatrist or an average therapist cannot treat me. And that's why it's so important for every medical provider and every psychotherapy provider to have that basic level of education around gender so that they can keep treating their clients and maybe consult with a gender specialist, but they shouldn't disrupt the care of the client just because they come out as trans. And if a psychiatrist is kind of missing those signs, well, maybe they just need a little additional continuing education.
I'd like to talk about some issues that would be applicable for all trans people of all ages. And one listener, Kay, shared many frustrations with their ability to access healthcare.
You know, I think these letter requirements for insurance that say that you've been diagnosed with a thing in order to qualify for a surgery, diagnosed mentally with a thing, it's bullshit. Honestly, a cis woman wishing to get breast enhancements does not need to be diagnosed in like a clinical, like there's something wrong with you sort of way, essentially what the insurance agencies are asking for. You don't need that to make decisions about your body if you're cis, and yet you do if you're trans.
I agree. I agree with Kay. And although I am a WPATH certified provider, so World Professional Association for Transgender Health, I think many of us, especially actually trans and cis providers alike, but definitely trans providers like myself, feel that there shouldn't be a mental health rubber stamp that we put on people to address medical care. You know, as long as somebody's capable of providing their informed consent, they should be able to access the medical care that they need. I think this is a longstanding kind of struggle of the trans community and the legacy of how medicalized our communities have been. And I think there are changes that are kind of coming down the pipeline, hopefully with the standards of care version 8, which are being worked on currently. I think some of those things might change for people. But literally, honestly, the way I address kind of writing a letter for a client is first of all affirming that I wish you didn't need this letter because I shouldn't have to kind of prove that you need to access this medical care. But the way I approach is let's be collaborative and let's look at this as a portal for you to access the medical care that you need. But maybe let's also use it as a moment of reflection to make sure that you've thought through everything that you need to think through, that you are prepared for the medical appointments that are to come, and that you are prepared to make an aftercare plan, for example, when it's gender-affirming surgeries. And so I think there is still a role for therapists, but I would like for people not to feel forced to see me, but to choose to see me, because I didn't become a therapist to become a gatekeeper. I want to be supportive of people rather than having to just put a rubber stamp and say, yes, you are who you say you are, and now off you go to the endocrinologist or to the surgeon.
I have to say, I completely agree with Alex. And I think, you know, I only work with young people, but I see and I fear that by having these requirements, that doesn't leave space for the conversations to happen authentically. Kids learn, I mean, kids and adults, I'm sure, learn what the words are that they need to say in order to get the letters. What we want to do is to create relationships with, you know, between the medical provider and the patient and their parents or the behavioral health provider to give them space to, for them to be authentic, for us to ask them, to tell them, you know who you are. What does that mean for you? And how can we help you achieve those goals so that they can say, you know, actually, I'm not comfortable with my chest tissue, but I don't want to go on hormones. And we can help them achieve those goals rather than just having them feel like they need to say a prescribed statement in order to be able to access the care that they want or need.
What else would be on your wish list for improving access to gender-affirming care?
Well, insurance is a huge barrier. It's something that as a medical provider, I have to deal with all day, every day of my practice. In trying to help to convince the insurance companies to cover care. I'm fortunate I practice in a state where the state Medicaid Oregon Health Plan covers all aspects of transgender healthcare from pubertal suppression to therapy to hormones to surgeries. But this is Oregon is not one of, is a rare state that has the state Medicaid that's covering these treatments. Many states don't have coverage through the state Medicaid. Many commercial insurance companies have barriers or exclusions, and that really affects individuals' ability to access care. The care is expensive, and for our pubertal suppression medicines, They're cost prohibitive without insurance coverage. So we need more inclusive insurance policies, number one. But number two is, just as Kay was mentioning, we need more expansive understandings of what this care means, and not have barriers that are specific to trans care when it's offered, the same care is offered and covered more easily to cisgender people seeking the exact same treatments.
I have to echo much of what Kara said about insurance as well, being pretty discriminatory sometimes when it comes to trans folks. I would say that treatments that, as you pointed out as well, are accessible to cisgender folks suddenly are not accessible to trans people, and that's really problematic. But in terms of what would be on my wish list, the first thing would be to stop discriminating against transgender and non-binary people and just see us as people first who need access to necessary medical care. Because often what happens is, as soon as that diagnosis of gender dysphoria kind of flags in the system, people look at us as if we are completely different from the rest of humanity. And so I think that stopping discrimination is the first step. But then I think another important step is for all of us, trans or cis people, to really look at gender and understanding that gender is actually a complex biopsychosocial construct. You know, yes, there is part biology, part identity, and our sense of self. So that's the psychological piece. And then there is a social piece that it's also historical in how we think about gender. Because I think if all of us thought about gender a little bit more and realized how many of our ideas of gender come from kind of family or history or teaching, there could be a little bit more space for everybody to be a little more expansive, to be a little bit more themselves. And I think that would go a long way to actually make life better for trans people. Because often when people think, oh, let's talk about gender, they think about just one category. You know, let's talk about men, or let's talk about women, or let's talk about trans people. But the reality is that all of us have a relationship with gender, and all of us are impacted by this idea of gender as a binary, which is also pretty modern in a lot of ways. And if we can really challenge that, I think life could be a lot easier for all of us, actually. We could all feel a little bit more liberated to be ourselves, regardless of whether we're trans or not.
That sentiment is sort of echoed in our last question from Tessa, who sent us this via the Sci-Fi Vox Pop app.
Affirming healthcare is healthcare that's backed by a wealth of data, research, and the medical literature. And while it's been established that there aren't any major negative side effects of medical transition, which is a good thing, beyond that, there isn't even, for example, really consensus on what the full effects of hormone replacement therapy even are for trans people. And I would love to see that remedied. We are a criminally under-researched demographic.
Kara? Comment, please.
I agree. We have a lot of research to back the care that we provide. It's a growing, rapidly growing body of evidence. But, you know, studies that date back 15, 20 years, even longer, about the positive effects and the lack of negative health effects from the treatments that we use. But we still need more research, and we need to center the voices of the community, the transgender and gender diverse community, in determining what needs to be studied and how the studies need to happen. So I think that there's an effort to pursue and support and fund research that does incorporate the voices of the communities that we need to study, so that they can help us establish priorities. And I think that funding agencies need to hear that as well. This is very necessary, and we need to make sure that we are hearing from the transgender and gender diverse populations, including the young people and their families, about what are the questions that remain that need to be answered and understood more thoroughly.
Absolutely. I would add, like, putting my scholar hat on, that we're both an under-researched and over-researched population. I think from the point of view of the social sciences or psychology, sometimes cisgender researchers pursue things that are of interest to them because they're not always well-informed. And so we're often over-researched in certain areas and very much under-researched in areas that matter to us. But one of the biggest changes that actually researchers can make is to include transgender folks in their larger studies. So if there is a large medical study of cardiac health, for example, include a category for transgender non-binary people. If there is a large study of bone health, include kind of trans and non-binary as an option, because then we're going to start to have those kind of larger data sets with longitudinal data, which is often what people are looking for. But as long as we assume that most of the population falls into this binary, we're not going to really have the comprehensive data that we need in order to kind of move the field forward.
And that's about where we'll have to leave it. Very interesting discussion. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Dr. Alex Yontefi, host of the Gender Stories podcast and a family therapist who works with transgender adults and children in Minneapolis, and Dr. Kara Connolly, MD, a pediatric endocrinologist and medical director for the Gender Clinic at Oregon Health and Science University's Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Portland. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.